Hi guys, how you all doing? Welcome to the latest in my series, Brown Car Guy and Buddies. And today I'm going to be catching up with another good friend of mine, Ronald Barlett. And normally I just introduce people to you in this segment, but he's actually written a fantastic introduction for himself. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just read that out. But before I do that, make sure that you subscribe to this channel, youtube.com/Brown Car Guy. Make sure you're following me on all social media channels. Just search for hashtag Brown Car Guy. That's on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And of course, subscribe to browncarguy.com. Right, let me read this. Ronald Barlett hails from the land of cedars, Lebanon, fabled for its snowy mountain caps, gushing rivers, and Mediterranean coast. Its winding mountain roads, deep valleys, and rally drivers, all 4 million of them. Ronald never aspired to be a rally driver, though he did try out for Navigator once. He was passionate about cars and the industry that made them and dreamt to work in the industry as soon as he figured out becoming an astronaut or president was things five-year-olds said. And being a pilot was akin to being a glorified bus driver. It's a bit harsh on pilots, but anyway. So he wanted to be a car engineer, but even that was not to be. And thanks to his skill in finding a way into whatever profession interested him, he's been entrenched in the industry for the past 20 years from the outside in. He is living the dream, and he's here with us today to tell us how he made it there and how he lives his passion every day. This should be great. Hey Ronald, how you doing? Great to finally catch up with you again. It's been ages, buddy.
Yeah, it's been a lot too long, I guess. We used to see each other quite often when you were here. And obviously with all the situation here, it feels even though we're more in contact, it still feels a lot more distant than ever. So really happy to have this chance to talk to you.
And talking about the situation, how has it been for you guys over there in Dubai?
Well, to be honest, I personally can't complain, and if I'm in a position, a job, you know, house set up that I'm very fortunate to have, and I can't. There's nothing I can complain. My heart goes out to those people that unfortunately have been severely affected by this to any degree. Life, you try to manage and evolve. Thankfully, we've got this kind of technology to help us keep doing our job and being effective. Again, not to It's an imperfect situation. It's a terrible situation for some, but hopefully, we can just push through this and keep our sanity, because it is a bit difficult.
And a bit. I think you put your finger on it. The key thing is to keep your sanity. I think that's the most important thing. Correct, so this is like, it's absolutely such an unprecedented situation, and it's so weird for so many people. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's like every time somebody says, how things are going, how's it going this year? And I'm like, this year, the object is to survive. That's it. Yeah. That's it. Just get to the end of the year. If you manage to do that, you're winning. That's how it is. Yeah.
But and hopefully that's 2020.
Yeah, hopefully that's 2020 done, and then that next year's a whole different story. But anyway, talking about getting somewhere and achieving something. So unusually, I read out your introduction, because I don't normally do that at the beginning of these things. But it was so funny that I just had to do it. But you talk about various things that you wanted to do, and yet you ended up here. One of the things you said, you wanted to be, you wanted to be an astronaut, was it? An astronaut or president? Well, wow. Wow. Set your sights high.
Yeah, correct. When I was a child, probably in the single digits, low single digits, we had this very famous milk commercial for kids where, when I want to grow up, I want to be an astronaut, right? But this kid subliminally drilled into your brain, right? Everybody thinks astronaut is the place to go. Yeah. And then afterwards, you've got aunts and uncles saying, oh, you're going to be president one day. The stuff they tell kids, right? And when I figured out that it was way overrated, and this is not something I wanted to become, it was two things on my mind, to be honest with you, throughout my, as early as I can remember, I was probably 6 years old, and I thought, I want to do something with cars, because I was so passionate about it since.
Where do you think that came from?
Well, according to my mother, I was born moments after she drove her way to the hospital, you know, so I could have been almost on the way. So I could have, that could have had an effect somewhere, I guess. And I've been showered with
Your mom still rocks already. She drove herself to the hospital. That's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Wow. So she was one of the first drivers in her family back home. And she was quite good at it. She's still good at it, actually. Mm-hmm. She's in her mid to late 70s now. And she still drives herself everywhere. So that's awesome. That's pretty awesome. And so that came from it. And my dad never stopped, you know, feeding the passion through whether it was, you know, Matchbox and Hot Wheels early on, then, you know, model kits. Then I think I was, when I was 10, I got my first, well, I got a lot of remote control kits before, but my first build it yourself Tamiya kit came in, I think at 10 years old or 11 years old. And since then I've been like, you know, I still do it to a certain degree today. So
your parents actively encouraged it. I mean, would they say that they inspired you towards it, or something that they went, oh, they identified, oh, he's into cars, let's encourage that?
Yeah, well, yes and no. So they encouraged that thing, maybe unknowingly, I think. You know, it's like, oh, he's a boy, let's get him that stuff. Yeah. You know, that's probably how it went in those days. Yeah. My dad is an engineer, so mother is in numbers, accounts, and stuff like that originally, before she gave up to be a full-time mom. So we've always been an engineering-driven type, you know, math thing. But unfortunately, I wanted to be, you know, when things started getting clearer, I wanted to be either a pilot or an engineer, or automotive engineer, not just any engineer. And then I discovered that, with all due respect to pilots, I hold them in high regard. It's not what I wanted to do.
In retrospect, given what's happened this year, that was probably not a bad move, because, I mean, God almighty. I was reading, was it 600 pilots have been let go by Emirates alone? I mean, I didn't even know they had that many.
No, they have a ton. Yeah, they have a lot. They have one of the biggest, if not the biggest, international fleet, at least. Yeah. But that's not, the point is, for me, was that in Lebanon, because I grew up in Lebanon, those are my formative years. We have a very small airline, Middle East Airlines. At the time, I remember they had like 8 planes. So let's say they got 2 pairs of pilots. That's not much to go into.
Not a lot of scope, yeah.
Yeah, Emirates didn't exist then. Yeah. We didn't even... And in the schooling system in Lebanon was kind of weird. They didn't really open up to globalism. You can go there and do this and do that. So it was kind of narrow. So engineering was where I wanted to go, but you needed to be good at all maths, all sciences in high school. And I kind of pretty much was really bad at chemistry, so never really could make it through that last level in baccalaureate to be able to go to engineering school. So that kind of wrecked my path there. Ended up in a literary type space. And after like about a year and a half in the undecided between law school and business school, I discovered automotive journalism and public relations. And then
So before we get into that, step back a little bit. So you said you went into the literary side. Was that a thing for you, writing and reading? Was that something that was inspired in you from an early age?
No, not to be honest. No, I was a bit of a lazy reader. I didn't read as much. I didn't write that great, you know, that kind of stuff. But however, when I was in business school, my like 1.5 years undecided, the last bit of it is I really was kind of lost. You know, again, there was no real guidance, to be honest with you. In hindsight, it would have been better. It could have been a lot better, giving you opportunities. Nobody told me public relations existed, to be honest with you. And I like the idea of it. So when I discovered it very late, and I was already pretty much in college, I thought, oh, car companies have PR officers? That's my way in. And I really put my sights on becoming a press officer or a communications lead in a car company or a racing team or something along those lines. And I just, you know, plotted a path and went through my degree very early on. Actually, the same summer I started working part-time. I discovered that I could write a lot better than I thought. So, and a lot better, you know, quite well. So I started writing for a car magazine. They were really gracious enough to give me the chance to write.
This
for
is in Lebanon.
This is in Lebanon. It was Alam.
I mean, in Lebanon, actually, I mean, just to sort of try to paint a, you know, for people that might not be familiar, but just to try and paint a picture of Lebanon. I mean, there's quite a strong car culture there, and particularly in automotive media there, isn't there?
Absolutely, yeah. Every one of us is a somewhat of a rally driver, as the joke goes. Well, a lot of people are passionate about cars and passionate about driving, especially, and their cars themselves. There's a huge car culture in Lebanon. It's very eclectic. You know, you go all the way from the high end to the lowest of low, in terms of like $1,000, you know, made up Golfs in the back of a, you know, garage somewhere. So these kind of things. So the range is quite big, everybody to their budget, but the passion is quite common amongst anybody that, and they're recognized vehicles, you know, and they have very good taste, I have to say. Even if they can't afford it, they'll go for a 25-year-old of that brand just so that they can get into that brand.
I mean, there's lots of, there's still a lot of old BMW E30s and things like that rocking around, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of old cars still hidden. Maybe not in the best of shapes, but yeah, if you go look for them, especially up in the mountains, you'll see some really interesting oldies, let's say, put it that way.
So this, this whole concept of, you know, 4 million rally drivers, I mean, that's you mentioned the mountain roads. Is that where this comes from? Is there a lot of hill climbs and rallies and stuff?
There are quite a few hill climbs. There's a lot of rallies. We used to have the Cedar Rally, the Spring Rally, and then you've got the Rally of Lebanon, the main one. That used to be a runner-up for the World Rally Championship stage, but then, you know, because of the issues in Lebanon and so forth, that never made it into the WRC. But I've had the chance to meet some WRC heroes of mine while they visited in the summer.
Who did you meet?
Muhammad bin Sulaym is the main one. I met him several times, and he still remembers the story. I met him the first time. I pretended, and I think it was 97, summer 97, 98, I pretended to be a journalist for the Daily Star. Right. And I snuck into Parc Fermé when they were fixing the car, not Parc Fermé, in the service zone before the end of the rally. And I had a chat that Peter Solberg I can't remember his name right now, one of the Swiss guys. He was pretty good. Not Swiss, sorry, Cypriot guys. Who else? Kevin Schwartz, Didier Oriol once was there. So I've met a few of them, shook hands, got their photographs. I don't know where those are right now, but for me...
I was just going to ask you. I was like, we could put some of those on screen if you know where the pictures are, but oh, man.
At one point, I was upset with some stuff, and I threw out a whole bunch of old things. So that was gone. So that these kind of things, like bits and pieces, I used to always follow. There was a rally stage that used to run twice a year almost. That was close to my house. So I'd walk down to the river, and it was a really nice road. And I've actually done that stage a few times myself, not in rallying, in my parents' car, stolen parents' car. Broke the car a few times. So
do they know this? Because they will now.
Never ended up in the river, which is a good thing. So because I've seen a lot of rally cars fly straight into the river off one of the crests there. So it was all these little things. I had cousins that were really interested in Formula One. So I've been following Formula One since I was 12, mid-93 season. You know, and gone through all that up until 2005. I hadn't missed a single race on TV. I've never traveled to one except here in Abu Dhabi once. But I like them on TV better than in person.
To be honest, it's the easier way to watch them.
And otherwise, all these little things got me really focused on cars.
So what magazine did you start working for or writing for in Lebanon then?
So my first one was Alam Sayrat, which still exists today with our friend Richie. They had their first foray with, I can't remember the website. It was called Arabia.com or something like that, and became MSN Arabia later on. So they used to underwrite all the car content. Mm-hmm. So I was in charge of, turning their Arabic stuff to English and making it publishable, let's say. I did that for about a year and a half. And then from there on, their deal with that website, aggregator stopped, so I moved on to Arab Motors, which later become Arab Wheels, and as a freelancer for quite a few years, and then late 07, early 08, I moved on full time as the editor of Arab Wheels magazine. Worked there for 4 years, learned the ropes of what happens in the publishing, gathering story research, test drives, reviews, all that kind of stuff. But my aim, sorry to break some journalist hearts here, is always to move on to the other side.
Always to move on to the dark side, as we say.
as they say. I used to call it the clear side, because when I was at the agency, you could see both. You were friends with the client and friends with the media, and you were just the facilitator. And we've worked quite a bit together when I was there. So I did manage to get an opportunity to work on the agency side for Rolls-Royce Motor Cars. And then from there on, Thankfully, I got an opportunity at GM a few years ago,
five years ago. So you're racing ahead here, as you would do, but that would be an amazing opportunity to get to be PR for Rolls-Royce of all the brands in the world. I mean, God, talk about landing on your feet, right?
Yeah, I have to say, like, this is all, again, just as a journey here, and this is something I look back and fondly on, and I wish to part on a lot of other younger people that want that. There are chances outside the, especially from conventional places where they think being a lawyer, an engineer, or a doctor is the only way to go. There are other ways. There are other ways to get.
So let me just ask you, because that's a very interesting point, and it's something that I've covered in a few previous videos, including a video that I put up a few weeks ago, which was "It's Not Easy Being a Brown Car Guy," and that was all about the culture and how, you know, we grow up in our social familial circles, and sometimes our particular cultures are not really conducive, you know, to these kind of jobs and these kind of professions. So did you find that you were encouraged along the way, or did you find that there were obstacles and people said, no, that's not the right thing to do? You shouldn't be doing that. You should be doing something else.
Oh yes. But from family and relatives and some other people that just didn't, you know, if you're not one of those three, you know, the Trinity, you're not doing it right. Or
I mean, did you get the whole, when you were working for the magazines, did you get the whole, what do you do? I'm a journalist. Okay, when are you going to get a proper job? Did you get that?
Yeah, from some people, from very close people, I have to say. So it's like, you know, again, it goes back to culture and the thing. I was never part of that, to be honest with you. I always, you know, I grew up my life through from Lebanon to the U.S. to Kuwait. I spent a good chunk of my childhood in Kuwait because of the ongoings in Lebanon, the civil war and all that stuff. So so because of, you know, I met people from all different sorts of life, especially when I lived in the U.S. in the early 90s for a couple of years. So all that gave me that experience and that, you know, that it's not just in love. There are other things out there. And then I had to find out for myself how to get to where I wanted to go. You know, Lebanon is a small place. There are no regional car offices. There are no car manufacturing. Yeah. You know, if you're in a car space in a country like Lebanon, you're either a rally driver, as jokey as that may sound, but it's true. There are some really great ones like Abdou Frale, Roger's brother, and a few others, Jean-Pierre Nostrella as well. All I've had the pleasure to meet throughout my career, you know. So you've got these, but they all have to do other things. It's not their career, but it's not really their 100% livelihood.
It doesn't sustain them, right? Yeah.
So, and obviously, you've got some really great guys that were in the publishing space for cars that made a life out of it, and you know quite a few of them. And these kind of things, but as a whole, the country is not conducive to do that in mass. Let's put it that way, and it's not clear. Yeah. So if you do that, you're an outlier in most of the cases. Now today, obviously, things are changing with the open up of anybody can become a journalist right now with a camera phone.
Well, this is it.
Things are changing.
Yeah.
As a good and bad, that's a different discussion.
Are we seeing more of this, of more sort of younger people coming on in Lebanon doing automotive content? And is that happening?
It's a lot more than it used to be, that's for sure. It's not as prolific as in countries here in the region like Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia's got so many of them right now. And they're all, and some of them are really impressively good at what they do and really meticulous within the space of the culture, of course, you know. But they're doing some really good stuff. So, yeah, we didn't have, like, when I was starting up, I didn't have that. One, I liked the vision, to be honest with you. And that always comes with training and, you know, being open to a few things. And the other thing was that it's just, you know, the market itself, this is why we always looked out to, a lot of us look out to Dubai, you know, you move here, you've got a lot more opportunity. And if you can make it from here as a springboard to some other place in Europe or the US, that's great, you know.
And so Lebanon is in the news recently. I mean, I don't know if you're keeping up with events there. I mean, how are things there at the moment?
I don't keep up with the news, to be honest with you. I left for a reason. That's to get away from all that. But my parents are still there, so I check in on them often. It's not good, to be honest with you. The country's never been in such a bad economic shape, even though in the midst of the civil war, it wasn't this bad economically. So there are a lot of people struggling, and it's not fair because the way it's happening is completely out of a lot of people's control. Like, it doesn't matter right now in Lebanon if you're rich or poor. You don't have access to your funds just put it that way. Yeah. Whether you have $10,000 in the bank or $5 million in the bank, they're not letting you touch it. So it's a bit of a weird situation for the country. And obviously the hyperinflation, or I don't know if it's categorized as hyper yet,
yeah.
but it's anywhere near that. The inflation is like crazy. So it's making a lot of people poor very quickly. And that's not good, you know. So
it's a shame. It's a shame. It's a beautiful. I mean, I was fortunate to go there once, and it's just such a beautiful country, and the people are just lovely. It's one of the things I found about it was just everybody was so friendly and so nice. It was fantastic, you know. But you talked about Kuwait, you talked about America, but you also took to sea for a while, didn't you?
Yes, I did. One of the things. So throughout my life, I've wanted to do several things in my life. You know, I wanted to live, call it a very rich life, if you will. But I didn't have the money to do it. So what I did do is I worked myself into these experiences. So I wanted to go out and party at night, and I didn't have the funds. So I went and became a bartender for a few years during college. When I was a friend of mine, one of my best friends, actually, he told me, like, did you know that you can go for a summer and work on a boat? And we were like 15 at the time, or 16. And that was like, that idea captivated me. So I think it was summer.
So you're thinking, I get to travel, I get to be on a boat, I get to have fun, yes. and I get paid.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's the best way to do it. And I don't want to do the cruise ship stuff, you know, because anybody can hop on a cruise ship, and there's too many people on the cruise ship. I really don't like that idea. So I had an acquaintance that was a motor yacht captain. So I rocked up to him one summer because I was really feeling down. I wanted to get away from the country, change the scenery for the summer. And the plan was only for a summer. And I go, like, hey, by any way, do you have a chance on your boat? I can jump on for the summer and help out. I'd do anything. I'd wash, polish, clean, you know, whatever you want. Change oil, whatever you want. So I was a bit mechanically adept, so I could help. He said, man, I'll let you know. Next day, one of his guys, you know, bolts off the boat. He doesn't want to work with him anymore. He goes, do you want to come in? I said, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then I, you know, I find myself 3 weeks later sailing in a, you know, force 10, 11 storm to Cyprus, all the way, we're going to Greece, and completely unprepared myself. So
had you been on a boat before? Had you been to sea before?
Yeah. Yeah, I've been quite a few times because I used to do the Lebanon to Cyprus to get out of trouble to go to Kuwait. I've been when I was a kid, but never on such a size boat and such a bad swell.
Yeah.
And the boat wasn't designed for that kind of swell, but we were under time pressure and we have to do it. So it was quite an experience and it got me my sea legs. And from there, I just fell in love with the whole experience. And because the job situation wasn't, you know, panning out, I was still looking. You know, applying to any job I could find within where I wanted to be. And then finally, 3 years later, after working on the book for just short of 3 years, Tony at the time, the publisher for Arab Wheels, called me up and he offered me the editor job. I was still writing for him remotely. And that's how I decided to come back to land and do what I've trained to do, you know, basically, and start.
But do you miss it then? Because 3 years at sea, that's quite a lot.
I miss it. Yes, often. It's a great lifestyle. It's not a lifestyle for someone that wants to be married and have a kid and settle down, because you never know where you are. Whether you're the captain or the deckhand, the owner might call you, or the charter guest might call you and say, "I want to be here and there." And your time is not yours.
Yeah.
You steal time away whenever it's free to make it yours. And yes, you can sit around. Yachties sit around sometimes and do nothing and live on a, you know, 6-star yacht and live. Everything paid for and all that kind of stuff. But it's not, at the end of the day, they rob you of what's essential. Like, I've missed a lot of things because I just couldn't leave the boat at the time. So I've missed friends' weddings.
Yeah.
You know, I missed my own courses to go learn sailing.
Right.
Because last minute, someone decided that he wants to go out that week and I had to be there. So it's that kind of thing. But it's very, if you're a loner, and you like that kind of lifestyle, and you don't mind living with people in close quarters. They could be total strangers.
So trying to segue this, did that sort of experience set you up to understand
doing PR for Rolls-Royce and the sort of clientele that Rolls-Royce has?
So yeah, when I was on the boats, I dealt with a lot of, you know, whether the first one was owned privately or the second boat I worked on, which was a charter boat and had a lot of affluent customers and some famous people, their demands are, you know, and not to knock them, you know, just call them arrogant or anything. They are who they are. They got there by being who they are. So kudos to them. You know, everybody has his own way through life, as long as you're nice. And I haven't met many that weren't nice. Mm-hmm. So I can't really complain. But the level of expectation is somewhere else. You know, yeah. Like you and I, maybe we'd go to a restaurant, you know, yeah. The hummus plate comes in a certain way, we just yeah. dig into it, right? As long as it tastes good, it's
you
fine.
You know, like whenever you're at the restaurant and you're sitting there and you're going, oh, this chicken's not done properly, or this salad's not ready. And then the waiter comes up and says, how's the food, sir? And you go, oh, it's great. Yeah, it's really good. Thanks.
Yeah. So these guys, like, you come in and the thing is not, like, I'd like my hummus twirled clockwise. And I've got that request, by the way, specifically. With X amount of oil of this brand from this country to this percentage, and also it's the lifestyle, right? They expect it. It's offered to them first and foremost. It's offered to them, you know, the yachting industry, the hoteling, the hospitality industry in general.
Yeah, yeah.
It caters to that, mm-hmm. and it elevates the level of you know, demand, if you will. And then they take advantage of it, and it becomes part and parcel. Oh, you want your car in this color? Of course we can make it for you. Oh, I can? Yeah. Yes, I'll order it in this lipstick shade or that, you know. And Rolls-Royce had that, you know, with 40,000 shade of colors that they can match anything. So, so
what was the most fun part of being part of the Rolls-Royce PR team?
Learning from the best, you know.
Really?
They operate at a very high level. So level of standard, level of, they expect a lot from you, and they recognize it if you do deliver. So yeah, absolutely, learning about the best communicators in the world. That's but something that is very something that taught me very well is that when you're communicating, when your message is more important than anything else. Obviously, your message needs to be relatable and relevant to your to your end audience, and that's fundamental in any type of communication you do. But your agenda and the way you want to present yourself is above all. So that's something they do, I think, maybe not better than anyone else, but with more tenacity, maybe is a good word. Like, you know, we are the best, we're ultra luxury, blah blah blah, you know.
Conviction
yeah, absolutely. Conviction is the word.
So the thing is, about the way I see it from the point of view of a journalist, I think that you probably, during your era at Rolls-Royce, particularly in relation to our market, which is the Middle East market, is when it actually really started to open up to doing PR and to doing, you know, I mean, I remember at Car Magazine, Car Middle East Magazine, we were the first people to ever actually review a Rolls-Royce. You know, that must be in 2008 or something like that. You know, whereas now there are press cars available and people are getting them. But at that time it was like, wow, and we actually got them through the dealer rather than through Rolls-Royce. And it was after that that they actually started to do proper PR and all of this sort of stuff.
Well, as much as I'd like to take credit for it, it wasn't me. So I was part of the whole plan. So because shortly before...
But there was a definite shift there, right?
There was.
Yeah.
There wasn't... it was led by Rolls-Royce. Obviously, they were at the time, the company was expanding their fleet. They had more offerings and all that kind of stuff. Mm. And I was just part of the whole... I was a cog in the machine to push that message out. They created their regional office at the time, which was new. They didn't have it. There was just like a desk at the group level. They hired their own agencies, you know, all that kind of stuff. And they had a dedicated resource here in the region that I used to work with.
Yeah.
So it was more focused from their end that ended up
I just find it fascinating that there was at that point in the 2000s, there was a fundamental shift in how Rolls-Royce did stuff. Because, you know, even before, Rolls-Royce traditionally was always this company that, well, we don't need to do anything because we're Rolls-Royce, you know. Yeah. But it was at that point that they went, no, actually, we need to start reaching out to media, to consumers, to influencers, to do this sort of stuff, you know. I remember being on a Rolls-Royce press trip and they said, yeah, we did one of these rounds we did just for influencers. And it's, some of them couldn't even drive, but that wasn't the point because it was a whole lifestyle thing for them, you know.
Yeah, and I think that company, you know, they were pioneers in that initially. They were about the first to pick that up.
Yeah.
And it was all part of a plan, you know, to democratize the brand. That's what everybody's doing these days, right?
Yeah.
So to make it more accessible, yeah. And it is the right way to go.
Did you manage to go on any of their events, launches?
Yeah, we did the race in Austria.
Because they do incredible. I think Rolls-Royce probably does pretty much the best car international car launches of anything.
Yeah, they don't do them often. That's why they need to blow them out of the they need to knock them out of the park every time, because it's one, it's the brand image. Two, they don't do them often. It's once every 4 or 5 years that you get a new car. It's not like you know, mass volume brands that introduce new cars every few years, you know, every year. So my journey to there was quite, it was focused, this is where I wanted to do, but even then that wasn't the end destination. So the agency experience taught me to work with very difficult clients, you know, manage all that. I did work with non-automotive, actually I had a lot more non-automotive clients than I had. I only had one automotive client.
Right.
I had tech, I had luxury, you know, I had quite a few different, I can't remember most of them right now. I had a brand that sold pots and pans, you know, so it was quite the, were the Rolls Royce of pots and pans.
But well, you probably kept the wife happy then. It was like, oh, I brought home some samples. Oh, awesome.
It did, yeah, I still have probably samples. But at the end of the day, the end game is the same, right? To get your message through. And it taught me a lot.
Yeah.
And obviously when I segued into the company I worked for today in-house, I did PR there for I think 3 of the 5 years. And for the past 2 years and a bit, I've been in their product marketing section. So it is where I wanted to be years ago. So at the end
of it, because you did PR for GM in Middle East, but now you're actually on product side. But PR must have been fun. I mean, GM has got some incredible metal in that market. I mean, we're talking muscle car heaven, aren't we?
It is. And
I've got to dig out that picture where I'm jumping between the two cars, and you photobombed me from behind. I've got to put that on screen. That's hilarious. But we had some good fun.
Yeah, it was good fun. And I had some like really, so far I'm still having some great experiences. So launching some of the best cars we've ever made. So but that's the whole way. And funny enough, when I look back when I was 6 again, to go back, is my parents bought a Chevrolet at the time. Uh-huh. And I've been a super fan of Chevy since, you know. I was 6. I didn't know that it was just another sedan, but for me, it is my first car. First car I drove, first car I crashed, first car I took my friends out with. So so I still own it in Lebanon.
What was that? What Chevy was that?
It wasn't a
muscle car.
Petrol heads car or anything. Yeah. I drove it like a muscle car. It was my muscle car, but it's not a muscle car.
Yeah.
It was a Chevy Celebrity sedan. It was the 1986 model year. So it's still there. It's got over 320,000 kilometers on it.
Okay,
it's,
send me a picture.
It's running away, unfortunately. Yeah, it's not doing well. I'll get you a press photo because my car looks terrible.
No. I want the picture really of your car.
It looks terrible. No,
it doesn't matter.
I spent almost
patina.
I spent all my savings on it in 2000 because it had my brother, my sister, obviously my mom and dad drove it for quite a few hundred thousand kilometers before I got it.
Yeah.
That was 2000. So I dumped all the money I had, every single penny into it, a lot more than it was worth. I could have probably bought 2 cars for that money, but it was mine. I had a new everything pretty much. Redid the interior myself, I remember, and helped a lot in the whole process. It took about 2 months and a bit at the shop, the body shop and mechanicals and stuff. But I learned a lot of mechanics and body fill, you know, metal work and all that kind of stuff with it. And
so you got a relationship with this thing, really. This is the thing. And that's the key thing when it comes to cars, isn't it? You can build a relationship with them.
Correct.
But working for these brands in the Middle East, I think just trying to create some context for people that might be watching this and they go, oh, American brands in the Middle East. But the historical context of General Motors across the GCC region is extraordinary. I mean, it's a long history that's really sort of contributed to the fiber of the culture there, hasn't it, really?
Correct. Yeah, we were among the first, if not the first, to get cars shipped over here. A lot of the oil prospectors, and you know, in the early days, they brought them with them, the trucks and all that. So, so the company has got a history. I think the first regional office, GM was the first company to open a regional office in the region.
It was in Jeddah. It was in Jeddah when I started.
No, before that.
Oh, the before that. That. Right. It so in the
80s. 26, yeah.
Oh, in 1926. 26. Right.
That was in Alexandria for the Near East office. And then from there, moved on to Beirut, from Beirut to Jeddah.
Yeah.
And then from Jeddah to Dubai in 86.
That's
so,
right.
So I think we're celebrating 84, 85 years.
It must be. Year. No, it must have been after 86, because in 89 to 91 is when I started journalism, and I was in Jeddah. And the head office was there.
Yeah, there was definitely a sales office there in those times, but a lot of the functions had moved to Dubai
so they were transitioning.
Or 87, if I recall. Right. And we're still in the same. We're still in the same office. Well, now we're at home, but theoretically, it's still in the same office. Yeah. So it's one of the. It's got a lot of history in the region, and there's a lot of love for the brand, and also, we're fortunate to work with such a great company here.
Yeah. This is awesome. Dude, we've run out of the clock. I always try to keep these to 30 minutes, and I always end up going way over, because once we get into chatting, it's just so great to catch up with everyone. But absolutely fascinating. I think we'll have to pick up the story again soon. But awesome stuff. I wish you and your family all the best. Hope your parents are okay in Lebanon. And you know, thanks so much for doing this. Let's catch up again soon.
Great, excellent. I'm looking forward to watching.
Take care. Should be good.
Cool. Wasn't that fantastic? That was a great conversation. Let me know what you thought of that in the comments above below elsewhere. Please do like, share, comment, subscribe, and all the rest of it. And of course, like I said, make sure you're subscribing to this channel, youtube.com/browncarguy. Follow me on social media, search for #browncarguy. That's on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And of course, subscribe to browncarguy.com. If you enjoy these videos, then consider supporting me on patreon.com/ShazadSheikh. And there you'll also find some exclusive pieces of content, which I hope you'll enjoy. Let me know what you think about it. If you can't, continue, like I said, to like, comment, share, and subscribe, and all the rest of it. That's much appreciated. Thanks so much for watching, and I'll catch you again soon in the next one.